Hi there, and welcome to the first ever Desert Island Dubs, a series of podcasts in which I interview someone and we talk about dub and we talk about which 10 dubs they would take with them on a desert island, where they would have those 10 tunes and those 10 tunes alone as company for the rest of their lives. Quite an important decision, I think you'd agree. By the way, my name is Giles. I'm part of Dub Conductor Sound System. We're based up in Manchester. If you haven't heard of us, where have you been? Check us out on dubconductor.com. That is the only bit of advertising I will do, I promise. Today, my guest is the founder of none other than The Disciples. That's Rusty. I went over to his studio in Surrey and we had a really good chat, mostly about music, mainly about dub, but there's all sorts in there, really good selection of tunes as well. Just a couple of side notes. First of all, we recorded all the tunes there and then off its record player, so there's obviously a bit of scratching, but I will make no apologies for that because I think that's all part of the magic. Also, I had a cold on the day, so listening back to my questions, you can barely understand what I'm saying half the time, so hence why I re-recorded my questions and kept obviously the audio of Rusty, so just in case it sounds a bit weird, that's the reason. Anyway, so hopefully you'll enjoy this. It's quite an interesting little listen and I'm hoping to do a few more, so if you want to get in touch with me, I'll put all the details on the link. You can let me know what you reckon. Thanks a lot, and so have a listen to the man of the moment, Mr. Rusty. Rusty, aka The Disciples, producer of reggae and dub music since the year of 1986, owner of the Backyard Studio, which we are sat in here today, and the renowned record labels Boom Shakalaka, Backyard Movement and Disciples Vintage. Paving the way for countless producers from around the globe, Rusty is an undisputed master of the craft of dub reggae and a pioneer of the modern UK dub sound. Russ, welcome to the first ever Desert Island Dubs.
Hi, thank you for asking me.
No problem. So to explain the format, we're shipping you out to a remote desert island, against your will, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. With you, you've got a pair of speakers, a turntable and a little preamp, nothing fancy. Here's the catch, you've only got space for 10 tunes. What are they to be? Obviously, I've prepared you for that in advance. So how was your approach for the selections that you
Some of it, you know, because you gave me a little test of taster of some of the questions being asked, and so they bring up memories of certain things, certain tunes that were significant, you know, regardless of whether they might be the best of the tunes that you might kind of like, you know, 30, 40 years later and stuff. It's just like, well, you know, some of these tunes were very significant at the time that I was into them and stuff. So I've kind of tried to kind of choose my selection based a little upon that. But, you know, when you've listened to music for this long, it's like, well, I could choose 100 tunes, maybe 1,000 tunes that I'd want on my desert island.
So my first question for us is quite a simple one. Why reggae?
It's something that's it's sonically interesting. You know, we had myself and my brother's older than me, and he's kind of been the one that's always introduced me in some manner to various types of music, from, you know, the Beatles to Hendrix to the Stooges, and then into the punk thing that we was into in 76 and stuff. But I was always kind of very open to hearing them things, you know. I wasn't kind of going to him and asking him what tunes. It was just like he would be playing them in his room, and I'd hear him and was like, oh, I like that. You know, if he was out the house, I'd sneak in and borrow the tunes and play them and stuff. So I kind of found, you know, it's like that type, you know, a lot of them kind of things, like Hendrix and like the Beatles and them type of things. It's, you know, it's not just the tune a lot of the time, it's the sonic interest that they've put into the tunes, especially like the later Beatles stuff when they're just doing all that studio work, you know, and it's just like they'd have all them bits of tapes and things running with sounds coming from left and right and little odd things, you know. Hendrix, if you listen to some Hendrix stuff, you're hearing similar type of things, you know, sounds coming, he's panning his guitar going from left to right. I mean, it's like, it's not, it's unnatural, but he's felt when he's sat in a studio at the mixer with the engineer and stuff, you can see in your mind, it's like, yeah, he's just wanting to do that with that, if, to get that effect, because it's like ear candy, you know, they talk about that ear candy thing, the thing that sort of, you know, you wouldn't hear it on a stage in a live show or whatever, but on a record it's a different thing, isn't it? And Jamaican music, reggae music, it's about studio, you know, the whole band thing and live thing of bands has never been a great interest to me for reggae. It was always about the studio, and you just listen to what they was doing sonically. So when I got into reggae, you know, my brother sort of I remember asking him what's a couple of reggae records to get, and I'd heard a little, you know, you'd heard sort of Bob Marley's No Woman No Cry and Israelites and them kind of things from, you know, early 70s. Everyone would have heard them things in some manner on Top of the Pops or whatever it was. But to get into it, and to get into it kind of deeply, it was like, you know, I asked him what was what, and he pointed out Dr. Mentali's Best Dressed Chicken album and Joe Gibbs' Chapter 3 in dub. And both of them albums are quite interesting, you know. A lot of the Animantado album is produced by Lee Perry, and everyone knows at that time in the 70s, you know, his whole thing was about sound, you know, what he was doing to kind of mess around with it and stuff. And even the Joe Gibbs dub, I mean, it's a dub album, so, you know, it's got all the reverbs and delays, but that particular album was also one that introduced you to sound effects that was put on top, doorbells and dogs barking and all this, which, you know, in retrospect, many years later, I've kind of read things from people that they said that it's like, oh, it sounds corny and stuff like that, which, you know, yeah, 30 years later, maybe it is corny, but at the time, it was quite revolutionary. Nobody had done that. So it was just like, it was very interesting. So I think them things appealed, you know, that whole sonic thing appealed to me.
And would there be one particular tune that sort of stands
out?
Well,
yeah, it would have to be Best Dressed Chicken.
Yeah.
The title track by Dr. Amantado.
Ring it, 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 ring it,
There we had the eponymous Best Dressed Chicken in Town by Dr. Anna Montado. So what was it about that tune? I mean, you spoke about it being sonically interesting.
Yeah.
I think that's quite well,
you know, the whole album is good for me. You know, I could just listen to it back to front.
Yeah.
And I did many, many times when I got it, you know. And it's like a showcase album. It's got vocals and dubs. You know, many of the dubs mixed by King Tubby and Philip Smart at Tubby's studio, so it's got everything on there, you know what I mean? Vanna Montado's voice, how they've kind of, you know, just it's just a repetitive, mostly a repetitive lyric, and you've kind of put the long echo on it and stuff, and then you've just got these funny little shrieks and stuff, but then you've got that loping bass line, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's just so deep.
Yeah. It's got it all.
Yeah, it's got it all.
So we sat here today in the backyard studio just outside of London. I suppose the 80s would have been the time where immigration was on the rise. A lot of Jamaicans coming through, bringing with them their music and culture. Is there somewhere in London that you were finding out about all this music? Was there a club or a radio show or something like that that sort of pricked your ears at the time?
There wasn't really, because you know I've lived out in the suburbs where it's not a black area for a start. So we didn't really, you know, you didn't sort of get that multicultural thing in this area. You know, during really the, you know, the most part of the 70s was more into rock music and stuff. That's what we're kind of growing up with. But the music press used to write a lot about reggae. You know, so you had, you know, Melody Maker, Sounds Magazine, New Musical Express, Record Mirror, a few other magazines. And they would always have articles on reggae on them. And that's what you would kind of see. You know, you'd be thumbing through looking, you know, by the mid-70s when I was into the punk thing, you'd be looking for Sex Pistols and The Damned and The Clash. But you'd also see Burning Spear, Dr. Amontado, Lee Perry and all that, you know. And I remember, I mean, it's more probably significant for my brother. You know, I remember it because he was a big reader of the rock press from early 70s. I was always into it. So when he see a name like Dr. Amontado, if you're from the suburbs and you've never been involved in reggae, you see a name like Dr. Amontado, that's like, that's, what's that about? That's interesting. It's weird, you know what I mean? And that, if you're into music in a deep way, it's like that kind of sets off a little thing, you know. You have to start reading about this, and then you might see a crazy picture of the guy, and you know, and that's sort of like, oh, that's interesting,
yeah.
You know. And you know, it's not always that you're kind of hearing the music at that point, but it's like you're seeing these little things, and then when you do hear it, it's just like, yeah, I'm liking that, you know. The black community thing wasn't really a thing for us in the 70s, really and truly. It probably didn't even come till much later when we started getting into Shaka and stuff. You know, because then we started going into the black community because we wanted to go and see Shaka.
Yeah.
But that was a long time after, really. You did have David Rodigan did start on the radio in the late 70s. Probably his first couple of shows that he did this little selection thing, Version Excursion, where he'd play a new version of a tune. Then he would play an older version of it, and then even like the original version of it. And one that always has stuck in my mind. At the time, I can't remember what year this was, whether it was 79 or 80 or something, there was a new version of this tune called 10 to 1, which was an old soul tune, an impressions tune. There was this new version by a guy called George Allison, and, you know, he played that. It was out on a 12-inch, and it was quite nice. Then he played Johnny Clark's version from, like, the sort of mid-70s, you know, like 77 or whatever it was, for Bunny Lee. It was like, yeah. Then he played the original Studio One Mad Lads version.
Wow.
And it was just like, when you heard that, I can, you know, even now, I can get goosebumps thinking about it, you know. It was just like, yeah.
Change to one. There's no difference in what they say.
From what I said earlier, you know, the main shop that we used to go to was Daddy Cool's for buying our records. And Studio One, which that production was from, was quite sort of hard to find, especially singles. You could find albums, but singles was always difficult. If you went into Daddy Cool, you maybe see, like, you know, a handful of different Studio One titles. And in the basement was where you'd kind of normally look for oldies and stuff. So we'd go down there. And there was a guy that worked in there for just 2 weeks. Probably didn't get on with Keith, so he was just in there for 2 weeks. Keith was kind of a notorious character. You know, we was looking through the rack at these Studio Ones, and you just did, just in case there might have been something in there. And he said, do you like Studio Ones? He says, yeah. He said, well, go down to Peckins in Shepherd's Bush, Askew Road. So I was just like, all right. So the following week, we went down there. And Peckins was a kind of, there was another little kind of notorious story of Peckins. If you went down there, depending on what time of day, he probably wouldn't even be in the shop. And he wasn't when we went down there. But there was a tyre shop, you know, like somewhere you, car tyres, so yeah, retreaded car tyres and stuff, next door. And the guy see us standing outside, we were looking at the shop and, you know, wanted, it's got open on the door, but it's locked, nobody inside. He said, go down to Bookies. So we go, you know, so go down the road, down Askew Road, in at the Bookies, find George. George was the original owner of Peckins, Daddy Peckins. And find him in there, take a slow walk back to the shop, pick up his patty from the patty shop, go in there, and it's just like you walk in and it's got, like, you know, a whole wall just with 7-inch in these racks. And you'd have kind of, there was one set of racks which was just, you know, the records were out of a box and just plunged in the racks. You know, he knew where everything was and just would, you know, would go through and pull out the copies and stuff like this. And then the other side, you had them still in their kind of boxes, and on the side of the box you'd have titles written. So you'd be straining your eyes trying to read these titles like headways on. When you see a tune like that, 10 to 1, it's like, you see 10 to 1 on the box? It's like, yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? Declaration of Rights, the original Declaration of Rights, and blah, 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 you know what I mean? So it's just like, yeah, yeah, we're all picking up these things. Spend about £30, nearly 2 weeks' wages at a time, buying up all these Studio One tunes.
Okay, let's talk about you as a musician then, Russ. Mm. So what sort of age did you pick up the bass?
It must have been about 14 or 15. And not through any sense of wanting to pick one up. It was just, my brother played guitar, you know, but I never really kind of got on with guitar. It was a bit too fiddly for my fingers. My mum used to run a catalogue, what they call a mail order catalogue, which would have been either Littlewoods or Trafford's. I think there was one called Trafford's at the time. And people used to order through stuff through her catalogue. She acted as an agent. And someone had ordered a bass guitar. But when it come, they didn't want it. And I'm kind of looking at it and thinking, I want that bass guitar. So, how can I have it? You know what I mean? It's just, yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's, had that and, you know, sort of started to get on with the bass. Oh, wow. My brother showed me how to play a bass line on something. It wasn't reggae. I think it was a Stranglers, a tune called The Grip,
right,
by the Stranglers. Sort of learn how to play that, you know. But I never really kind of took playing the bass any kind of with any seriousness. It was just like, yeah, it's, you know, it's there, just fiddle about with it. And stuff. It wasn't really kind of till many years later that I kind of, you know, started getting into making music. Mm. So
there's every chance we've got Littlewood's catalogue to thank for.
Yes.
The Disciples.
Or Trafford's. One of them two. Of them, so.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
So, but I take it then you weren't really looking at other instrumentalists at that stage.
No, I mean, you know, that wasn't a thing for me. It probably still isn't. You know, I don't kind of sit and listen to records thinking, oh, that's such and such a bass player, or you know, this is that, but done by that one. What amp is he using? What bass guitar is he using and stuff? You kind of pick up little parts of them things over many, many years, as you do. You know, if you see an old picture of Robbie Shakespeare and he might hold in one of them Hofner violin basses, it's just like, oh, that looks interesting, because it was like the Beatles bass as well. You know, I mean, it's just like you wouldn't think that, but there he is in this old picture with him playing the Beatles bass. Other than that, you know, you wouldn't really kind of... I wasn't really concerned with you know, who played what. You tend to check reggae for, is with dub versions. It's like, you know, where is it mixed and who's mixed it? That was more you kind of...
Well, it's back to the thing you're saying about the studio.
It is the studio. The studio is the more important thing.
Yeah.
And what is done with the end result of a tune.
Yeah. More about the studio in a minute. First and foremost, let's move on to track number three. Are we on
Well, off of that, what can I choose? But this is where I was a bit stumped. I suppose I should just choose a favourite tune.
Choose a favourite, anything.
Which has got to be King Tubby's Meets the Rockers.
Okay.
Because it is the most significant dub ever made, in my opinion.
Is this the one that people say this is the perfect dub?
I will say it's the perfect dub. Yeah. I mean, I've put it on Facebook before and kind of said, you know, this is the dub of dubs. And other people come and say, yeah, but this tune's heavier and that tune's this and that tune's this. It's like, yeah, but this was the one.
Called it the perfect dub a minute ago.
What's
perfect about
The whole lot? I mean, just, you know, the rhythm, the mix, you know, that triplet kind of delay that he's put on the hi-hat that just makes the whole thing roll.
Yeah.
you know, and then them little snippets of vocal just pushed in the right points, the chops just jing, 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 you know what I mean? It's just like, yeah, that's Tubby's on full flow there. You know, the few knobs and buttons that he's got on his mixer, he's just pushed them and done the thing in exactly the right places. You can't get no better than that.
We've talked about forays into the world of playing the bass and listening to these tunes. Can you perhaps pinpoint time where you just decided, right, this is it, I'm going to pursue this on a serious level and start making some
Yeah, tunes? Well, I suppose, you know, when you start making music, it's always started as a hobby.
Yeah.
You know, for myself, it was just playing around with sound. You know, I remember having a cassette machine at mic inputs and stuff like this, and I had some hi-fi speakers that, you know, had like separate bass, middle and treble, and I would dot this microphone around to a different speaker. I'd have another speaker in the middle of the room, and if you pull that microphone in the middle of the room, if you pull that speaker out, all the sound goes recorded from that speaker. You get this really strange, like, it's a dub mix of you know. So I was doing it all these dubs. I probably did it with that tune, that King Tubby's. Did a mix of the mix, as it were, with these speakers. Just put it into the bass speaker and just go. Whoa, whoa, whoa. And so I was kind of interested in messing around with sound, but didn't know nothing really about recording equipment or anything like that. Yeah. I remember seeing a music magazine and seeing advertised, you know, things like little four track for like £500 that's got its bit of EQ and is everything's there for you to be able to kind of record. And whilst I could play a bit of bass and I had some little kind of cheesy keyboards, some toy keyboard yeah. things and stuff like that. So I remember going into a local music shop asking about drum machines and stuff. And they had like a Lindrum in there, but it was £1,500. It's like, I was probably on about £40 a week. How am I going to afford, you know, a £1,500 drum machine? But Roland had come out with the little Roland beatbox, that little silver box now, which fetches a lot of money, you know. So I bought one of them, but it sounds shit for doing reggae. You know, it's really, really thin and tinny. But it was cheap. I think it was like a couple of £100 or something. So, you know, I could do some little drums and just start to kind of practice, and that's what it was, practice. And my early stuff was complete rubbish, but it gives you an idea of how to start using some of this technology. You know, I remember getting a couple of dub plates cut for myself of various little things, just because I wanted to hear them, how they sounded off of the vinyl product. So that was the only way you could kind of hear your music like that. You know, you wanted to hear them with the snaps and crackles of vinyl, like your old records and stuff, not this, you know, clean sound that you're getting off a cassette tape and stuff. So I did that, you know. I mean, I used to play that to a couple of guys, and that's when, you know, they kept saying, you should take it to Shaka, you should take it to Shaka, you know. And some of them, you know, they was like saying, yeah, it's all right, you know what I mean? It's like we had got to a point where it was just like, it wasn't sounding so cheesy.
Yeah.
It was sounding a little bit kind of like, yeah, it's getting into the right proper realms and stuff. But still at that time, just a hobby. You know, and even when we went to Shaka, when we finally kind of took ourselves to go see Shaka, not in session, but, you know, to kind of meet with him and show him our music and stuff like that, it was still a hobby. We give him the dub plate and, you know, he listens to it and likes it and all them kind of things, and tells us, you know, there was like four different tunes. I've told him the stories many times, four different tunes on there, and he's asking for more mixes and four mixes of each tune and anything else you've got and blah, blah, blah. So you kind of get onto that. But even still, it's still a hobby. You know. Really, the serious part, where I kind of take it really seriously, when it was just like, you know, sort of a few years after dealing with Shaka, when I'm thinking, well, because he had already put out some albums by us and stuff, still a hobby. Mm. But it was like when I kind of got to a point where I can't keep pressuring Shaka to put out our stuff. I've got to put it out myself. And it's when you start to think yourself, I've got to put out my own things, then it's when you really start to think it's more serious. Hmm. And there was quite a number of years, I mean, a good probably, you know, 6 or 7 years between going to Shaka and then really taking it seriously. But I suppose there was a seriousness in the fact that I would have been, you know, trying to upgrade my equipment and trying to get a better sound and stuff like that. Even when we did the first album for Shaka, it was just like he was going to put out the stuff that we had done on the fourth track cassette. And I was thinking, oh, it's got to be better done than this. We need to go into a better studio. And we hired a local studio and did some things. But that turned out a bit of a disaster and a waste of money because it wasn't a reggae studio.
Yeah, right.
And it was like taking someone that's never been in a studio, putting them in a studio, saying, "There you go, there it all is. What does this button do? What does that do? What does that reverb do? What is it?" I was like that, you know what I mean? I didn't know none of it.
Right.
All I knew was my little Porter studio, you know what I mean? So the results of that weren't no good. And Shaka did end up putting out the little four-track things on the first album.
And so that's what we can hear on,
yes,
on the very first album.
On the very first album is the first four-track. And on the first dub plate that we give him is a tune. It's a title track, really, to this album, Commandments of Dub Chapter 6, Deliverance. Deliverance dub. So the first dub plate that we ever give him. I never got that dub plate back either. He's still got it.
Next, I wanted to ask Russ if there was any non-reggae influences behind the music he makes.
I mean, I did listen to things like, you know, a bit of house music and some other stuff. And a little bit later, I listened to some drum and bass and things. It was never really that much of an influence on what we was doing. You know, what did influence us was Jamaican music always, you know. But what I think made us make what we make was the limitations of what we had to utilise to make it.
Yeah.
You know, if we was trying to do a tune that sounded like a Jamaican tune, we didn't have the sounds that were needed to make that Jamaican tune. You know, we didn't have the DMX drum machine and all that kind of stuff, you know, with that particular rim shot sound and stuff. I had a Roland U220 sound module, and its rim shot sounded like this. You know what I mean? It was totally different.
Yeah.
But what can I do to try and get it more into the realms of what I wanted it to do? So I detuned it an octave, so it wasn't going like kick, it was going conk,
right?
You know, so them kind of things. It was like utilizing what we had to make our thing. One of the kind of main tunes, which wasn't one of ours but one that sort of was quite revolutionary, was Dread and Fred's Warrior Stance.
Yeah,
you know, because I mean, it come out I think in 89, but Shaka had been playing it for a year or something before. When you heard that tune, and even what Shaka was doing, I don't know whether he was influenced off of Dread and Fred, but he was doing some stuff in the studio. When I had this first album out, I went to go collect copies from him, and that was 87. And he was working in a studio in Brixton, Barrington Road Studio. And the room, which probably wasn't much bigger than this, but it had seven DX7, Yamaha DX7 keyboards, a little Roland MC300 sequencer and a couple of SEC 1282 mixers. All these keyboards were going to the mixers and stuff like that. But he was working with a guy called Andy, he called him Andy Mozart, and he was one of the studio engineers or workers. But this guy was a wicked keyboard player. So Shaka was getting him to play all these melodies and stuff at the time, but these rhythms were just, because they was coming all off, everything was coming off of these DX7s, drums, keyboards, everything, synths. So it was very mechanical. And Dread and Fred's tune was very mechanical. It might have had a live, I think they played live bass on it, but the overall feel of the tune, very, very mechanical. And all them keyboard synths and stuff like that. Very revolutionary. And not sounding like anything else. It didn't sound like Jamaican stuff at all. But them things, I remember when I heard Shaka in the studio and I come out after I picked this up my phone, and instead of making my drum machine sound like a live drum, which I was trying to do by the second album, it was just like, oh, I'm going to make it sound mechanical.
Okay.
And see what that sounded like. You know, we didn't use things like claps and stuff like that, but it's like, well, it's on the machine. We didn't use them because, you know, Freedom Sound, you didn't hear it on Freedom Sounds tunes or Pablo or Yabby You or whatever, you know what I mean? But all of a sudden I'm hearing, you know, Shaka you building these rhythms and Dread and Fred building these rhythms, and they're very mechanical like this. It interested me. So, you know, a lot of credit should go to Dread and Fred at least for what they did at that time. I mean, they never seemed to really capitalise on it later.
No.
You know, but at that time, yeah, they hit upon something.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't want to do stuff that sounded like exactly like Dread and Fred, because I still had that. I wanted to have some influence of Jamaican music in this. I was trying to kind of combine, in a way, the two kind of elements of what was going off there and do it in my own thing, you know, and just trying to do my own thing as it was. So, but it kind of pushed me into moving away from like playing a live bass and all that into doing everything kind of programmed.
I see.
And I suppose all that kind of led on into what, you know, is later being termed as UK dub.
So, I mean, do you think it might be the case that, say, in a fantasy world, you start getting into reggae and then suddenly you have all these musicians and singers at your disposal, your sound would have been dramatically different, do you think?
It probably would have been, yeah. I mean, I probably would have got, if that was the case, I probably would have even gone more traditional reggae than anything else.
That's interesting. Yeah. And it's just, I suppose, in an indirect manner then, because of the kind of electronic music that was very prominent of that time, the equipment that you could buy was reflected in it. So therefore, the sounds that you're using, by their very nature, would be a bit more dance music-y or electronic.
Yes.
And so then, just because of that, that's why the sound emerged.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Very good to know. I'm glad that reggae has remained pertinent in the...
It still is for me, and if anyone's really checking more what I've been doing over the last 10 or 15 years, it's been more reggae-orientated than anything else.
Absolutely.
You know, what I did in the early part of the 90s is not really what I want to do now. But even if I try, I find it hard to do it sometimes because I kind of spent my ideas on doing it back then. When you're talking of an expanse of time like that, you can't be doing the same thing for 20 years. 30 years.
Yeah.
It's really tedious.
Written here on my notes for track 5 to perhaps reflect this influence that we're talking about, it turns out.
Well, there is no particular influence from techno or dance music, but I've always loved other kinds of music.
Okay. Yeah.
And there was, you know, one album that I had out in the mid 90s or 95, an album called Resonations, which had lots of kind of stringy sounds and all this sort of stuff on it. And there's a few people that I knew always used to say to me, you like Alice Coltrane, don't you?
Oh, right.
And I said, yeah, I love Alice Coltrane. And if you listen to the stuff that she did, in particular, this track that I'm going to play next, Journey in Satchidananda.
Oh, yeah.
With Pharoah Saunders.
Yeah.
Is just beautiful. And all this shimmering sound. Mm. It's like a wall of sound. It's like Phil Spector, but in jazz, you know what I mean? And I've loved that. And I still love it. And I still kind of, you know, when you get that, when in reggae and when in dub, when you got that hi-hat going, you know, with a triplet delay on it or something like that, it's almost trying to sort of do that in its own kind of manner, get this shimmer of sound going off.
Thank you. Right then, I'll let you back announce that one if you don't mind, Russ, because I struggle to pronounce the title.
Yeah, so do I. It's Journey in Satchidananda.
Okay.
By Alice Coltrane, featuring Pharoah Saunders on saxophone.
Let's go back to the reggae world, I think. So I'm just thinking now, as far as the timeline goes, where were we? We just started to put your tunes out, and Shaka's put out a few albums. Shortly after that, the sound system came along, Boom Shakalaka.
Well, obviously, you know, going to Shaka and seeing it, it's an awesome thing to experience and stuff. And you know, you're not just in awe of the tunes and all that. It's just like, how is that all happening?
Yeah.
You know, all the things like, you know, cutting out the bass and the effects and whatever, you know, it's like that when you don't know what it takes to get that, it's like wow, it's like mystical. But then you kind of start to find out a little bit, and when you get into sound system you find out a lot more. But my brother had been doing a little fanzine called Boom Shakalaka. He started that in the back end of the 80s, and through that, you know, we started connecting with a lot more people where we didn't really know anybody in the scene. You know, through the magazine, we started to kind of meet more people because they would pick up the magazine in Dub Vendor and Daddy Cool and wherever it was being sold, and connect with us. One in particular was Joey J, who was on Kiss FM. And he was like one of the people that did bring a lot of white people, well, just a lot of people generally, into listening to the music and stuff through being on Kiss FM and playing it all. You know, it was very we could pick up Kiss FM down here on the radio, and you know, he was guesting Shaka on his show and stuff, and it's just like hearing that was Shaka playing some of his old dub plates and all sorts of things, you know. But Joey had started up a club up in Dingles, up in Camden Town. And you know, I'd been inviting a few guests along to play and stuff, at which one time he asked my brother, because of doing the magazine, to go up and do a guest spot. At the same time, I went along and I had a cassette with a couple of productions, new productions on that wanted to try and kind of feature. It was really, my brother was just going to go along and play some oldies. Bob Brooks, who used to run a record shop called Reggae Revive. Again, notable for selling oldies and stuff. So it was, you know, that was their selection. Then, you know, kind of right at the end, I'd run these couple of tunes off of the cassette tape and see how they go down, because really basically it was the same crowd, a lot of the same crowd that was going to Shaka. So we kind of knew that, you know, they'd appreciate hearing new tunes as well. So there was no issue with playing that in what was, you know, potentially a revived dance. And we did that and we kind of got a little bug for it. And then Joey started doing some sessions down in Southall Community Centre. And he had his sound system, his Great Tribulation sound system, which was his and his brother Norman J's sound system. Because at Dingles, I think it was just a club system. But in Southall, it's like they brought in their sound. And they asked us to go along there as disciples this time, doing our thing, playing a selection and a local sound. Asian sound called Eastern Shear, and you know, they was getting a good crowd down. I think the first couple of dances they was doing free entry just to get people into coming in the door, and it was like rammed out, you know, 400 or 500 people in there sort of going for it and stuff. But playing on Joey's system or playing on anybody else's system is always kind of like a slightly lesser experience, because they always want you to kind of like keep things down a little bit, you know what I mean? When you want to go a bit mad with the bass, they're sort of like, they're going, you don't, you know what I mean? And Joey was always a bit like that, you know, and didn't really kind of show us the preamp too much, you know what I mean? It's just like, you know, he'd point to the bass button, that was it, you know.
That's
what
all
I mean?
You need to know.
Basically, just want us to be there playing tunes and get the door money, you know. But after a little while, I sort of felt, you know, was really kind of interested in it. And I'm sort of thinking, yeah, I wouldn't mind getting a sound system together and doing this ourselves properly. So that's what I did. And it took about a year to build up. You know, got a loan and this sort of stuff and built the speakers and whatever, you know, and started going out there. And because there wasn't that many sound systems, relatively, you know, we was known through our music through Shaka, we had a following kind of more straight away. We didn't have to work at it too hard.
Okay.
Just straight away in there, and, you know, we're getting the 300, 400 people at these dances and stuff. So it was, you know, quite good period. And, you know, we was getting asked to do various other bits of dances. South End was playing down there, sort of a fair bit. There was a couple of, about two or three promoters down there, all vying to do stuff. So we was down, you know, playing them. And, you know, in Southall we was kind of, there was another promoter that used to do Vauxhall the Arches. So, you know, we was kind of playing in there a bit. All these places that Shaka areas and that Shaka played in also. And playing with, you know, Abba Shanti when he had come out at that point. And Iration Stepper. And we kind of, there was a guy up in Bradford called Roots Man, who was doing some nights up there called Doubly Crazy, with Iration, because them two were kind of linked strong at that time, and then bringing us up there with our sound, sometimes to play off of Iration's set, sometimes to play with our sound, so we go up there and take it. So we was getting the dances and doing the work, and it was, you know, it was quite good at times. It was hard work, and, you know, I find it really hard to remember a lot of the dances, a lot of our own dances. You know, I have a more memory of going to Shaka and particular things in their dance and what tunes have been played than I do any of my own.
Yeah.
You know, because you're kind of thinking more about all the technical side. And
it's a completely different experience.
And, you know, and how tired you are at lifting the sound in and out of garages and venues and driving, you know, hundreds of miles to places and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you can't even remember the dance afterwards. But yeah, so that's how we kind of got into it. And, you know, just through a vibe, really, and seeing an opportunity to do something.
Yeah, sounds like a worthwhile investment.
Yeah, it was for a while, you know. But then it kind of got to a point, you know, where it was just like, where we initially had kind of ideas of, like, you know, because we had come off of Jamaican reggae and stuff, and really that's what we love to keep playing. That, you know, we always played oldies, and, you know, we was into kind of some of the new productions and stuff, where some of the sounds weren't so much. You know, Abba wasn't really playing too much Jamaican. I mean, I don't know if he played in the oldies, but he wouldn't be playing much Jamaican new stuff. Whereas, you know, if we heard anyone that was kind of in the right frame, we would be wanting to run them and stuff, you know what I mean? We loved it all, and we had, you know, kind of ideas, if this thing kind of picks up, we'll, you know, try and make connections with some of the Jamaican producers and get, you know, dubs or exclusive tunes or fresh tunes or whatever, you know, the natural course of running the sound system as we saw it, you know, because our years of going to Shaka, we always used to hear Shaka going off to Jamaica and going off to New York to pick up tunes and stuff. So it's just like, you know, that's what you did as a sound system, you know, meet up with these people and get the good tunes, you know what I mean? But the kind of way it went, you know, during that early period of the 90s with Iration coming down and ABBA and all that, it was like it went more into this UK dub, which for the first couple of years, even for ourselves, it was just like, yeah, it was good, you know what I mean? Because it was fresh, it was very fresh and kind of exciting and new and what have you. But after about 5 years, it was just like, you know, it's like there was no room to play any Jamaican stuff anymore.
Right.
You know, some dances we were doing, and it was like people were just kind of like standing around while you're playing them tunes, just waiting for you to play some new Steppers dub thing.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt a bit disappointed with a lot of that. Yeah. You know, it wasn't where we kind of initially saw ourselves going with it all.
Yeah.
But it just kind of moved into this thing.
I see.
And so, you know, by 96, it was just like, we wanted to finish.
Yeah.
Wanted to finish with it.
That's fine.
It ran its course.
Sure. Well, I mean, certainly these days, sound system politics seems to be quite rife, just because through the medium of people online, I think. Mm. So I want, was that still a thing back in the day, or was it
a little bit? But I mean, we never really kind of had it so much ourselves. I think partly because our music had been played by Shaka, and everyone had a lot of respect for Shaka.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, a lot of them were after the tunes that we made for Shaka. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't give out none of the tunes I ever made for Shaka.
I see.
To anybody else. It was only when I had a little cut-off point, you know, sort of when I stopped making tunes exclusively for Shaka, and then some of these other sounds, ABBA and Iration, could get certain new things and stuff that I was doing. So that kind of made them happy. So we was kind of almost everybody's friend. But I know there was a lot of rivalry between some of them bigger sounds.
Yeah.
And even rivalry with Shaka and stuff, you know. And it wasn't always from the sound themselves. A lot of it would be able to do with other people around them, promoters maybe, and you know, other people that's involved in trying to make money off of each of them. So they would stir up stuff, you know what I mean? And that kind of didn't help. But there was, you know, like I say, there wasn't so many sound systems around, or at least, you know, ones that were visible around. So you kind of had, you know, everybody was kind of getting their little piece of the cake.
Yeah.
And there was promoters and there was venues, you know, that things could go on. But, you know, come later, you know, after we had finished our stint of it and stuff, come later, it's like, you know, when venues are sort of becoming harder to get and all that, I think competition comes in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I also think, you know, it's like, in a way, I mean, even though a lot of our dances were like, we always played another sound, when we used to go to see Shaka earlier on, most of the dances that I ever saw with Shaka was just Shaka alone. It wasn't ever, you know, I saw him play Channel One once, I saw him play a couple of other sounds once or twice. Fat Man, he played about three times. I see him in that period, Fat Man had come back out. The big one with Fat Man and Coxon and Shaka.
Famous.
You know, yeah, the famous one there. Yeah. But most of them, the dances were Shaka alone. And I particularly enjoyed that. I preferred just to go to see Shaka alone than I did ever go to see him play any other sound. But, you know, with the kind of smaller or the up-and-coming sounds as they were, it was just like, you know, I think the promoters thought, oh, we need to get a clash going off to draw more people in.
Yeah.
So it was always two sounds in there. And so inevitably, even though it's roots, supposedly, it's always a clash because they've all got big egos.
Yeah.
And so the clash element comes into it, you know. And sometimes I kind of think that ain't always a good thing.
No.
Because it kind of, it steers them into playing too much of a particular thing.
Yeah.
Instead of them, you know, just kind of, if they're playing by themselves, they can just get into their root of it and their flow, and that can kind of lend, it can ebb and flow. If you've got two sounds in, it's like if one starts to play a stepper, the other one's got to play a stepper, and if they've played a stepper, you've got to play a stepper.
Because
if you play anything kind of slow and mediocre, you're going to get the down vibes. You're going to drop off.
Yeah.
So it's always about, you know, all the boom, 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 boom all the time. Whereas if you're playing by yourself, you can make it go up and down.
Yeah.
And people will follow that naturally, because you will kind of, if you're a good selector, you will know the tune, how to follow a tune with another tune.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I find that much better myself.
Yeah.
Than any kind of clash thing.
Yeah.
The clash thing can be funny for a little time while some big argument might be going off, but it don't really make for the greatest dance, I don't think. You know.
Okay. And on the subject of a greatest dance, do you have a sound system? You know, we've touched briefly on what makes a sound system tune. Do you have a particular tune that you feel like is a real sound system tune?
Well, I suppose, you know, it will be one of the classics more than anything else.
Yeah.
Which will be Kunta Kinte.
Of course. Yeah.
Which I happen to have on dub plate.
Oh, wow. Okay. Next up, I ask Ross, have you got a secret weapon tune you use in the sound system arena?
When you go over a period of time, you have, in a way, they're kind of secret record, secret weapons for a period of time. Like, you know, sure. For 6 months it's this tune, and the next 6 months it's that tune, and the next one is...
Yeah.
They have a little kind of period of time, because then you wear thin of them.
Yeah.
They're no longer secret anymore, you know what I mean? Because, you know, even the rarest of rare tune now doesn't really mean that much in a dance. And even at that time, it didn't really kind of mean that much.
Mm.
But it was more like there was a couple of tunes of my own that... Well, there was two tunes of mine that, you know, any dance that I did, I was always having people ask me to play.
I see.
So it's kind of like, you know, which one of them two would I choose? And I can only play an extract.
Oh wow!
Because
it's that secret.
It's not that it's secret, but it's really kind of very wanted.
I see.
I mean, I've had people offer me big money for the tune. It's like I don't let it go because it's got a singer on it. That singer's sort of disappeared. I don't know where he is. You know, not a known singer. So I can't really do anything with it. I'll kind of just, you know, it's always been me alone with that one tune. You know, everyone's always asked me for it and stuff. And, you know, they was like, what about the rhythm? And it's just like, nah, the rhythm and the song go together.
They're locked.
No one can have that tune, you know. I mean, I have been seriously offered some big money for it.
Okay.
So, yeah, it can only be an extract.
Right. We'll take that. Is there a title for that tune?
Wicked Man.
Wicked Man, of course. Yeah.
Oh. That tune there, you know, it's like if I didn't play that down south, it was just like, you know, I'd probably get a slap or something.
Oh, that would
you know
what I mean?
Yeah, it's just one of them things, you know. I'd even have people come up with their mobile phones and typed out in there and kind of go, but there was another one as well, a Serious Warrior tune that I did. People always kind of requested them two got the most kind of requests in dances.
Right.
But I used to play them out a lot for years and years, even up to my last days of playing them out. They'd sort of get in there in some kind of manner, and you know, I always had a way of playing it without no bass, just let the thing kind of run, and people kind of, because you know, a lot these days as well, people don't do a lot of them things where they just kind of tease.
No.
Tease people with sounds and stuff, you know what I mean? So I just keep the bass off right near like the whole tune, just right towards the end. He does this thing where he goes, "Oh, ja," like this, really kind of reaches out, you know what I mean? And then
climax.
Just drop the bass right after, you know, this big, immense bass, he's like this, and everybody just start going crazy and stuff, you know.
Certainly see why.
Yeah, it used to have, when we had the sound, it had a real kind of impact like that, because you could just drop it kind of, just with the right kind of weight, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just,
Right, so let's have a look at your labels. Mm. So three labels to talk about. You've got the Boom Shakalak, of course. I understand the first tune came out in 1993, is that correct?
That's right. Proud and Lion was out in 93.
Yeah. Then you moved on to Backyard Movements, and that's 96.
Yeah.
And then you've got the Disciples Vintage, which is the more sort of a repress platform.
I kind of just decided to set that. I've probably got more labels than that because I just decided in later years to just do individual labels for every release. So whatever label was called, just because I kind of got bored with seeing the things on the same labels. I kind of like sitting there just designing.
Oh, I see. That's
little labels, you know what I mean? And having them have their own little individual. Yeah. Type of thing. A couple of other producers I know say you should have your kind of logo, you know what I mean, like your branding and stuff. Yeah. But I've been there and done that. I don't know if it fully works with everything. Maybe it might do, you know what I mean, with promotional kind of ways. But I kind of liked having different little labels on things and designs and stuff. Breaks it up for me.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I did the digital tune with Dixie Peach
on
Disciples Digital, so that's a fourth.
Yeah.
You know.
Of course.
And there's just the Disciples label that I had Third World Man on with Vivian Jones. So, you know, I could theoretically I've got kind of many labels. But you might see the Matrix number to them might still be, you know, BM 00 or whatever.
So you haven't set them all up individually?
Nah, I try and keep the Matrix numbers in a kind of order.
That makes sense.
It's reggae. It has to have some quirks.
Never a truer word spoken.
Yeah.
My next following question was going to be, what was the reason behind separating the labels? But you sort of just explained that. But
yeah, there was a significant reason for doing the Backyard Movements, which was, as you've suggested, to put vocal tunes on. And the vocal tunes to me were kind of, you know, my aim with the production was more towards the kind of Jamaican yard kind of tunes than, you know, the dub thing, which, you know, the Boom Shakalaka label had its releases. So I wanted to differentiate them because I kind of, you know, you have to be aware that there's different people into different things. I was very aware when I did my first Backyard Movements tune. My previous things on Boom Shakalaka, when I used to send them in to say Echoes, Black Echoes magazine to get reviewed, a couple of times they was reviewed quite badly.
Oh, right.
You know, sort of taking the piss out of them being dub tunes. Where's the vocals? Where's this and where's that? You know what I mean? It's like almost as though, you know, I couldn't, you know, by the reviewer, I couldn't make a proper tune for them.
I see.
So when I did the first Backyard Movements tune, which was Judgment Seat by High Priest, I sent them a white label copy. I didn't even send them a label copy. I just sent them a test press with nothing else on it except for Judgment Seat, High Priest. That was it, you know what I mean? And it got a good review.
Right.
So I thought, my work's done. I've kind of proven to this guy, you know, that it's like, you can accept my tunes.
Yeah.
If you don't associate them with maybe who I am, me personally, and what scene I've come from and stuff. Because they're very, you know, always kind of dismissive of this roots.
Sure.
Dub shaka scene and stuff as though it's just like, because it kind of, you know, it sort of had a rep, our scene. And yet, for reggae people, it wasn't its rep. You know, it's like, for reggae people, it's like, you know, the Jamaican side of reggae people, it was like what was coming from Jamaica, that was the important thing.
Yeah.
If it come from over, it had to come from maybe, you know, those that were still associated with the Jamaican form of it,
right.
Jamaican artists like Stingray would have done or whatever, you know. But our roots thing, our roots dub thing was kind of like, yeah, that's something that should just stay in the corner. So I wanted to prove, well, as a musician, I can make tunes that you can listen to and appreciate.
I see.
But I have to kind of fool you a little bit first. So do this Backyard Movements label and just kind of let you appreciate it for what it is, just as a tune.
Yeah.
Rather than any other stuff that you might think is bogging up your mind. And it did work, you know what I mean? So I kind of kept that up for the vocal tunes. That was a separate thing for me.
Yeah. What I was going to say about well, right now where we're sitting, you can almost see a history of equipment. There's so many dials and faders and all sorts. And I can see a chaos powder over one side, and then a very sort of analog-looking phase unit in this corner. So, has that been like in terms of your production methods? Are you sort of open? Have you got a fairly open policy to what sort of equipment you use, or is it just sort of adding to the tunes? Or
I'm fairly open. You know, it's you know, you buy equipment partly through what you can afford or what you might see at the time. You know, some of it's just stuff that you bought back in the day and you've kept on to. Obviously, with you know the whole computerized thing, it's kind of opened things up there as well. You know, because it's like I don't need to go and buy drum machines because really. You know, most of my drum sounds that even I used from the beginning of the 90s, I used to use samples.
Yeah.
You know, I had my first sampler was something, a Cheetah SX-16, very basic sampler, at about 1.5 seconds worth of sample time. The only thing you can put in that is drum sounds.
Yeah.
So it was like a 909 kick because it's nice and fat, you know what I mean? A couple of sampled hi-hats that I got off records and stuff, just because they were like, sounded more like the Yard. Type of hi-hats than the drum machines that I was kind of using that just had that kind of ticky 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 kind of hi-hat, you know. The Yard hi-hat can have that tss, tss, you know, that kind of bracing kind of sound to them and stuff. So, you know, nowadays it's like, you know, all my drums, I don't need a drum machine for the drums to come from, for the program stuff. It can all come out of a computer because it's all my samples that I've collected and, you know, put together over the years, as well as whatever comes within sample packs and stuff that you can purchase off the internet and that. So, you know, and a lot of other stuff, you know, all the native instrument stuff, there's like, you know, all the Hammond organs and things like that. It's kind of easier to have them in a computer than it is to try and find a suitable keyboard with them all.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I always have to think about the size of my studio, which is very small. There's a limited amount of space for stuff, you know what I mean? It'd be great to have a cool Triton in here, but it's like, where the hell would I put it? You know what I mean? It's a massive bloody thing. So, you know, you can look for modules and stuff, but then I'm even kind of stuck with space to put modules and stuff now, you know? Everything's kind of packed in tight.
Maxed out.
Yep. Maxed out. You know, there is no room for anything else.
No.
So, you know. But it's gone through lots of changes over the years. You know, obviously throughout the 90s, it was always kind of growing and all that. You know, and then maybe some years ago, I kind of decided to go in the box. I tried to scale it all down. Very compact and stuff. Work mostly in the box, use a little controller and do the mix from that and stuff. It was still hands-on mixing, but with a controller. It's a small little thing. But then I kind of, you know, after a few years of doing that, which was successful, you know, it worked and, you know, the mixes were good and everything, but I just was starting to feel a limitation in what I could, how I could mix. So then I got a small kind of mixer and was doing some things on that, but I wanted to replicate how I was mixing in the box, and I figured a way how to mix in the box with using a little 8-channel controller, but you're kind of working into groups, into stereo groups.
Yeah.
And I wanted, you know, doing things like in the box reverb, so you know the channel that like with all the piano ones would have its reverb come out on that same channel as well. So I was like, well, you can't do that on a mono desk on a mono channel without the reverb suddenly becoming all mono and kind of collapsed and not big.
Yeah,
I wanted to maintain a big sound, but I managed to find a small mixer that had stereo channels. This little one under here. So I did a thing on that, and that was all right for a year or so. But then I just, you know, I had this mad bug in my head about what would be my ideal mixer, you know, with all these stereo channels and all that sort of stuff. So I kept kind of looking around, because sometimes you're on like eBay, you would see stereo channels.
Yeah.
So I sort of had some mad idea, if you could collect enough of them together, or the same ones, put them all together, have some nut, put them together and power it, I might be able to get the ideal channel, you know what I mean, like the ideal desk.
Yeah.
I was looking around and I see this one. This is a Kadak.
Okay.
And it come with loads of stereo channels. And it's highly featured, and it was just like, I just thought, I'm going to go back into my analog.
Yeah.
And make kind of one last ditch effort to forward up again.
Yeah.
go and try and go a next level.
I'm with you.
As it were. I mean, the levels are always kind of fairly small.
Yeah.
You know, once you kind of know what you're doing and stuff. But that small little thing is a big thing.
Sure, sure.
In the end. So, you know, I decided to invest in this and some other bits of outboard. I still had some outboard stuff that from my earlier days, because I'd always kept on to it. Sold some bits that I knew I'd never need, but kept on to certain ones that I kind of thought I might need to access that at some point. So they're all here now. And just, you know, over the last year, I've just invested a little bit into getting this to a level that, you know, it's probably about as good as I can get in here.
You think you've optimised your studio space now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And pretty much the gear as well, you know. Sure. I mean, there's probably not a lot that I need to really get now.
You've reached the
and it's kind of worked out, and I'm kind of happy enough with it, you know. So, you know, the next step forward from here is to try and get back into releasing stuff, despite, you know, the current record situation.
Sure. Though it's making a bit of a comeback, is the vinyl.
In a way, but I was reading in a magazine this morning. From some mastering engineer, some like high-end American mastering engineer, you know, it was like saying, you know, he does a bit of vinyl mastering. It's not the mainstay of his business. I mean, you know, the current situation with vinyl pressing, you know, like people will say, is because a lot of these big labels are repressing stuff, or they're pressing new stuff on vinyl, but really it's still a minimum.
Yeah.
But even at that minimum, because there ain't the level of pressing plants around that there used to be, because all the big companies, your EMIs and CBSs and Virgins and all them, got rid of their pressing plants back in the 90s, sold them off and all that.
Yeah.
You know, they're having to go to the little pressing plants that the likes of we have been using since them time.
Yeah.
And because we're pressing up far smaller amounts than they will do, I mean, they might only press up a few thousand, but it's like, well, it's still a couple of thousand or more than what we will press up.
Course,
and so they're going to get the priority. You know, even one of the cutting houses that I went to, you know, they're saying it's like, you know, one of the major labels wanted to book them solidly 24 hour a day.
Is that right?
Which would have meant that nobody else could have got in there.
Yeah,
but they said to the plant, we can't, you know, they said to the label, we can't do that, we can give you, you know, half the day, and the other half we'd have to give over to our regular clients. A thing that everyone has to watch out for, especially them pressing plants and stuff, is if they give that work exclusively to their majors, the majors are going to stop soon enough. It's a fad at the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is what this mastering engineer was kind of pointing out. It's a bit of a fad that people are getting into vinyl, you know, like outside of reggae. And it will come to a cut-off point, and it's like, well, okay, we've done that now, let's look for another... The major labels will look for another way that they can kind of get their music out. Yeah, the next thing that they can try and sell to the public.
Yeah.
But for the pressing plants, if they've effed off all us smaller little labels and we're out of business now, they ain't going to get no new business, are they? They're going to lose out on the regular custom that they've had for all these years. So they have to watch themselves.
Sure. So
but at the moment, we're in a kind of position where it's like it's quite difficult for us.
Yeah.
Because the business is going off for the majors and stuff.
Sure.
And we're finding it hard to get in there. And manufacturing times are lengthy now.
Yeah.
You know, by the time you get your record, you're kind of bored with it. You know.
I suppose that's a bit of a conundrum in a way, because it's obviously the format of reggae is vinyl, and it should stay like that. But I suppose it must be a big temptation to just go, right, forget all that, let's just go straight to digital.
You know, it's hard. I mean, it's, you know, the thing, I suppose, you know, I will see it from my point of view, that it's very hard to kind of just go straight to digital and think just about digital, because so far my experience has told me my digital sales ain't at the level that they could even pay for an artist to voice a tune.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's so you'd make no money on it.
Yeah.
Whereas even if you could sell 400, 500 copies of a vinyl, you can still make a bit of money and pay an artist and such.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah. But it's like you need to get in the pressing plant to be able to press the bloody thing. You know, I've kind of looked around at a few other pressing places, because you have to try and keep your costs down as well, you know, sure, with reggae. So I'm always trying to think of that. I went to get a quote from one place in Belgium, won't take no new customers on.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So basically, this vinyl resurgence is almost killing off the existing vinyl.
it don't help.
Scene.
It's quite hard.
That's ridiculous.
You know, and you've got some pressing plant over here which is not doing good product at the moment. You know, a lot of scratchy pressings and stuff like that. So, you know, that doesn't put you in a good frame of mind to use a couple of people over here for pressing.
No.
So it's like, well, who else? You know, where else do we go? Yeah. You know, I mean, it does become hard. Yeah, you do start to run out of options.
Yeah.
So, but you can't give up. You know, in one way or another, you just got to try and keep
That's the spirit. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask moving back to the labels. Mm. And obviously, now that you've got this studio now, which is completely optimized and geared up, and you've got all these singers at your disposal, do you feel like you've found your true sound as a producer, do you think? Or
Well, I wonder if there is a true sound, you know. Sure. I mean I'm someone that's been quite varied in my production styles.
Yeah.
You know, from the dub thing to Jamaican yard stuff to, you know, trying to do sort of revival sounding stuff. It's very, you know, you're doing different kind of production techniques on each of them things.
Yeah,
it's not the same on all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So there can't possibly be a particular sound. But I don't notice it so much myself, but I do. I've had people always sort of tell me they can always recognise my tunes.
I think I probably could.
So I must have something in what I do which is, you know, a signature.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure if I know it myself. You know,
maybe
it's just what my ears are telling me when I'm doing my balance and, and whatever process and whatever reverbs. I know there's certain things that, you know, when I hear, you know, what kind of reverbs and stuff like, because reverbs have an ambience and that's always kind of part of your production, you know what I mean? And it's just like, you know, some people will choose certain types of reverb and I'll choose something different and I kind of like, you know what I mean, and do it in the way that I kind of like to do it and stuff.
Yeah.
And so that brings out a certain kind of uniqueness.
Sure,
yeah. I'm sure balance has something to do with it because we all have different ears and we all balance things differently and stuff. So,
that's right.
You know, but I don't know if, you know, I couldn't really say that I've got a template for doing any of it. It's just, I'm just sitting down here doing my thing, really.
So release wise what would you say is your proudest moment?
I mean, there's, you know, you have tunes that you can, you know, you tend to kind of love the tune you're working on most recently and stuff. There has been tunes that I've kind of, you know, older tunes that I've kind of pulled out even to this day that I still like to play and drop and think, yeah, that's still got it even from that time, you know what I mean? I might not have been happy with my equipment and this and that at that time there, but it still sounds nice and drops nice. And one of them tunes is Rashida's Howl Hymn.
Okay.
Which was actually my brother's bass line. He come up with a bass line, and I did some of the kind of synthy stuff and all that. But she had, we'd done the rhythm, and in one of our first dances, we were running tunes and stuff, and I run this tune, and Rashida had come in. And we'd known her because we'd already sort of started some work with her previously. But she grabbed the mic while this particular rhythm was playing and stuff, and she just started to come out with this little head tops kind of lyric. Hail him, Rastafari, the king, you know what I mean? Very simple, just that repetitive thing, and I called it on tape. I've got to try and find that tape, and I've still got it somewhere.
Yeah.
But I called it on tape, and then when I was kind of met up with her some time afterwards to start recording some more tunes, I said, there's one thing you've done, can you remember it? And she couldn't remember it, and then I played back the tape. I think I gave her a copy of it and stuff. I said, yeah, make something of that song there.
Rastafari, King.
Okay, so Russ, before we send you off to the remote island, you get a few more little perks. We're going to give you the full works of Bob Marley and the Wailers. Going to give you the Bible.
All the tough gong stuff.
yeah, all that. you got the Bible, whether you want it or not. A session tape of your choice. What's that going to be?
Well, there was a session, I can't remember the exact date of it and stuff, but there was a session with Shaka. Up in a place called the Africa Centre or the Africa House. There was a few venues up in the same place, up in Hackney. They had similar kind of names, but they was all in the same little street. Two of them, I think, were in the same building, and they called them. One of them was called Africa Centre, and one of them was called Africa House, and blah blah. So I can't remember precisely which venue it was. Okay. It was now. But Shaka had this dance. He'd been to Jamaica. Everyone kind of knew that was on that was within, you know, the circles knew that he had been to Jamaica, and they was expecting to come back with some some killer tunes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so there was a real kind of nice vibe, a nice expectation for a dance. So we went up. And up to this place, and it was up an upstairs venue and all that, and it was a nice vibe, and the club was full up, it was packed out in there, fairly low ceiling, so it was a nice tight sound and stuff. And you know, Shaka kind of started playing a selection. It was kind of going his normal way of tunes, you know what I mean? It's like, come on Shaka, you know, when you gotta draw your selection now and stuff. And, you know, we was all kind of expecting him to run into whatever he had got from Jamaica. Nobody knew what he was going to come with. But it was just that expectation. But then he put on his tune. It was one of my tunes. And it was a tune I kind of did release later. I didn't release his cut, so I released some kind of remake of it. But I called it O Jaja. And I called it O Jaja for a reason. In the dances, he's running his tune, he's running the first piece, and it's like he's picking up, you know what I mean? It's the vibe is already kind of picking up with the people, they're getting into it and stuff. Shaka's letting the tune run one piece, gets into the next piece, and by like halfway through the next piece, he starts doing some some of his kind of, I think something like his, you know, his sort of Rankin Joe-ish type of chat that he does, you know, and kind of getting it going. But and it's like it strikes him at one point to do this thing, this kind of chant, and he does it one time first off. He does this, ooh, Jehovah, you know, the twinkle thing from the Twinkle Brothers.
Yeah.
And then he playing, you know, the tune, as the tune's playing, as I remember it now, it might be a bit different when you actually hear it, but my kind of memory of it is that he sort of does it again, and then he says, "I would like to hear the choir."
Wow. Okay.
He lifts up the needle and starts the tune off again, and sort of starts the tune up and starts going into this, ooh, and then he says, "Choir," like that, and everybody starts to do this, ooh, Jehovah. The whole hall is doing this thing, and Shaq is not running no bass line, he's just running it kind of sort of fairly low,
yeah,
tune, you know what I mean, just to have this vocal, just, you know, the whole crowd just doing this chant, him doing it, you know, the whole crowd doing it, and they're doing it in response. Then he sort of goes from that, after doing that for a number of rounds, it's like he changes it. He goes, ooh, ja ja choir. And then it's, ooh, Joe, the whole choir is doing this, ooh, Joe. It's going on for the whole tune, you know what I mean? And it's like, when you see that response from the crowd and stuff, and I've never seen that before, I've not seen him, you know, in any other dance, him doing that, but he did it, that one there. And it was on my tune. It was just like, yeah. That was what it was like them times. It was, you know, it was they were Rasta session.
Yeah.
You know, not a rave.
Thank you so much, Rusty.
Hi.
You've been a great dub castaway. And
thank you.
I hope you enjoy your trip.
Yes, it's been a lengthy one.